Welcome to the CineStory podcast. This month we ask the question, what exactly does the term four quadrant mean? Recorded at CineStory 2012, here, development executives Leah Estrin and Jessica Julius discuss why writers need to understand this term and how it affects what kinds of scripts are developed in different genres and at different studios and production companies. Between them, Leah and Jessica have experience working at Imagine Entertainment, Disney Family, and Disney Animation, and their insights on the topic are invaluable. Enjoy.
Well, we were going to start with just being like, does everyone here know what four quadrant means before we delve in or what they think
well,
they
let
know
me guess.
Mean.
Men, women, young, old?
Yes,
that would be the generic,
right. most
the easiest way to think of it. Yeah. And then it can break down even to more quadrants, and some people believe a studio won't make a movie unless it hits two of the four quadrants.
Mm-hmm. And generally, but it basically, what that means in practical terms is simply, like, you need to hit a large audience. So I've talked to all of you guys about this, actually, a little bit, about knowing who your audience is, and it's true. And I think family films tend to be one of the few genres that actually need to work on a four quadrant basis, because you need to have all of those quads come to your movie in order for the movie to be successful, and that's who you're targeting with your films. You know, you're like an R-rated movie is never going to be four quadrant because you're missing out on the young, and depending on what the subject matter is, if it's a raunchy comedy, a lot of times you end up with a more male audience than female audience. If it's a treacly romantic comedy, you're going to end up with a more female audience than a male. So it's...
But then there are cases where films are four quadrant but not family films.
Yes.
Neil was like, what's
absolutely.
That? And I was like, it's called Titanic. Four quadrant, mm-hmm. but it's not a family film.
Yeah.
You know, but it's hitting that younger demo because it's usually like under 25.
Yeah, I think I can't remember what the cutoff is. I think it's like 18
teenager.
And under. Basically, it's like teenagers.
But teenage girls and boys are going to see Titanic because
yeah.
the girls want the romance, the guys want to see the ship sink. You know, but it's not. You wouldn't call it family because you're not going to take your younger kid
yeah.
to watch that movie. So you can go a little bit into one or the other, but really, there are family films that aren't four quadrant. But they're usually like direct to video.
Yeah.
And
honestly, they're direct to video. They're designed for the kids more
yeah.
than the parents. And that's the other thing when you're thinking about a family film and you want to make sure you hit the adults. You know, kids don't take themselves to the movies. So if the parent
mm-hmm.
doesn't want to sit through it, the kid's not going to go.
Yeah. Most Pixar movies are a really good example of four quadrant movies.
Yeah.
Almost all of them. You know, I know plenty of people who are my age, who are, you know, early 30s, don't have kids, and wanted to go see Up or WALL-E or Ratatouille, you know, but there aren't many people who would, my age and my demographic, who would necessarily want to go see Hotel Transylvania, which opened this weekend, or like Ice Age, because those tend to skew much more young,
yeah.
younger. Parents go to them because they have to, because they have to take their kids to them,
mm-hmm.
but you want to try and target, you know, the rest of us, too, like, one thing, you know, Disney has Wreck-It Ralph coming out this November, which I know some of you are very excited about. And the great thing is it's the first time in my life since working at Disney Animation where when people find that out, that I've had people my age, guys and girls, but men especially, who don't have kids who are like, I can't wait to see that movie because it's about the gaming world. It's about video games. And it's been fabulous to have that. It's been wonderful to have that, but it is, I mean, but part of it when we were making that movie, we also had to be very cautious and cognizant of the fact that we also want to get the non-gamers in there, so we want to make sure that the movie still has emotional heart, and this is something that I think every single four quadrant movie has, is sort of an emotional through line, or they have just phenomenal characters. So most superhero movies by default have to be four quadrant movies because that's the only way they'll make their money back is if they get every single quadrant in the theaters.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why you don't go for like no name. When we're talking about four quadrant, what we're talking about is marketing. We're not talking about creativity to a large extent. And you know, but the truth is Hollywood is a business. It's not, you know, and I told all you guys this too. It's like, if you want to work in Hollywood, you have to work in the business of Hollywood. If you don't want to do that and you want to work in existential, I keep saying existential, what I mean is experimental film.
It's also existential.
It is existential a lot of times. But if you want to work in the experimental film world, then that's fabulous. Like, do it. But just know that it's not going to be mainstream by default. You know, I mean, the indie film industry was grew up out of a sense of like wanting to try and make movies that were not part of the Hollywood machine and were able to tell stories that you wouldn't, that wouldn't have to hit the four quadrants, that you could do the smaller, you could go for just the women in their 30s and above quadrant, that you could go for just the adult audience and not have to worry. But then those films are also budgeted far lower than, say, The Dark Knight. You know, I mean,
which I would say isn't, I mean, once again, that's another example of four quadrant, not a family film. Like,
yeah,
you should be taking your young child to it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm sure there's somebody who did, but
right,
they
sure
shouldn't. But that's one of the things Justin and I was talking about earlier is that we're reaching the point right now. We're going into that fall award season. Those movies aren't four quadrant movies.
Yeah.
They're really usually appealing for adults.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's great if younger people want to go, but they're... And they're made for price. They're not, you know, they really read the budgets on those, you know.
Yeah.
That being said, I'm sure something like Life of Pi probably had an
right
expensive budget, but they're rating on the back that it's a book that people loved. And
mm-hmm. It's a known brand.
It's a known brand, so they're going to throw more into it,
mm-hmm.
you know. So it's that weird mix.
You also have the bonus with that movie. That's a really good example, actually, that they are probably going to be targeting Four Quadrant because it's a younger protagonist. It's not a child, but it's a younger protagonist. So you're going to get people in the theater who are a little bit younger because they want to see that. And actually, that's something that you and I were talking about a little bit earlier, too, which is that your protagonist, especially in family films, people have a tendency to want, as writers, you want to try and write what's real and what you know and what you feel is like actually going to happen to your characters. And a lot of times what ends up happening is you'll want to write a character that's, say, 8 or 9 because that's the age that they would be in this story for your family. But by doing that, you're automatically eliminating anyone over the age of 8 or 9 from wanting to see your movie because children are aspirational. They don't want to see stories about people who are younger than them. They want to see stories about people who are older than them. That's why you'll see in like every Disney movie, every Pixar movie, most of the time, all of our characters are older. They're, you know, they're in their, I mean, and by old, older is a loose term, but it's like they're 18 or 19 or, you know, they're in their young 20s. They're not... That's very old.
But
it's very, it's fairy tale time is a very old age to be. But it's true because kids don't, like 5-year-olds will go see anything that, you know, that's 6 or 7, 8 or 9 because that's cool. But they don't want to see a story about a 3-year-old. 9-year-olds don't want to see a story about a 5-year-old. They want to see stories about who they aspire to be, and that's teenagers, you know? So that's just something to keep in mind, too.
You know, it's very true. I mean, I think it's one of the things that Diary of a Wimpy Kid was people thought it was middle school, like junior high or going, but it's actually that group a little bit under
mm-hmm.
who, oh my
who
god,
actually go see the movie.
But then who are reading the books.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you know, I think you had the middle school, the middle school kids probably reading it maybe in their first year and thinking it's funny, but you don't probably, they're not sticking around for the third movie.
Yeah.
They've out-aged it a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, because with the Disney Channel, it's one of the things when I was there, when we were I was helping them find material, it is very clear. They're like, look, our audience is kids, you know, 6 to 14. So our leads are 14 to 17, but really they're 15, 16. You know, they're that age break, because that's who they want to be.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for them, going to high school is a big thing. Learning to drive is a huge, you know,
mm-hmm.
is a huge adult moment, even though, like, you look back on it and you're like, that was not... you know, what it's supposed to
the
be.
The life-changing event that it was.
So it
built.
Is, the kids are always looking
yeah.
up the thing. And then,
which doesn't mean that you can't, that you shouldn't write about characters who are younger than that. And I want to make that clear. That doesn't mean that you should not do that. All it means is that by doing that, you are automatically limiting your audience. And that's okay, too. I mean, there are successful films that are not four-quadrant films. There's plenty of them. So don't feel like that means that you are never allowed to write about some characters that age. Just know that by default, that means you are limiting your audience.
And I would also say there are also examples, like especially for a feature, a live-action feature, where it's supposed to be a family film, you'll see a lot that the adult is kind of the lead, but there's a lot of kid characters for multiple ages. So like the example would be like Cheaper by the Dozen or The Pacifier, where... kids, you know, like the action guy who's having to do all these weird things. But then there was, you know, a high schooler, you know, the senior, the, you know, freshman, and then there was a middle schooler of the kids, so that there was something for everyone.
Yeah.
And then Cheaper by the Dozen had that. Like, there was a whole full range of kids of age, but Steve Martin is the character with a big arc in it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how you get everybody in. So that's something to think about when you're writing yeah. that kind of stuff.
He had a question.
This may be further along in this conversation, but what are the kinds of situations to, I'm just going to say, to avoid putting younger characters in so they're not so threatened that the audience thinks that the screenwriter or the director is almost creating an abusive situation.
You mean like mortal peril or something
like
that?
Yeah, you know, like,
it's about tone. I mean, yeah. You look at a movie like A Fish Called Wanda, for example. Are you guys all familiar with that movie? Do you know this movie?
I love it.
Okay, it's a great movie. And one of the things that they struggled with early on, and this isn't a child, but it's still one of your characters, was the character, oh my god, I'm blanking on the actor's name, with the dogs, who is always kind of trying to steal the dogs. Every time he would do something, somebody would get hurt in the process. And there was one scene in particular where a safe fell out of a window and landed on the old lady with the dogs.
Yeah.
And in an early cut of the movie, the safe actually landed on there, and you saw it, and you heard the smack, and it completely turned off the audience. Because they were like, oh my god, a dog actually died in this movie. Like, it changed the tone from being comedic to suddenly being very real, they lost the audience. And if they had kept it in, it changed the total tone of the movie, and it would have had to have a harsher rating than what it ended up with. And by simply moving the camera away and changing the sound effect of when it fell so that it didn't actually feel like a dog actually died in this movie, they got away with it. So it's about what you show and how you show it. So you can put a kid in danger, but if it doesn't actually feel to your audience like this, an actual child was being harmed in this movie, then you can kind of get away with the other parts of it.
In A Fish Called Wanda, it was actually Michael Pena, that's where Kevin
yes,
Kline was.
Yes, yes, yeah, yeah, yeah.
It was Ken in his book of pets.
Ken, that's the word, that's his name, the character's name is what I was thinking of.
Is that a screenwriting decision? Let me phrase that. Is that, do you have any idea if that was in the script or if that was a decision made later in the editing process?
If they filmed it in a way that showed that, that means it was a decision made in the editing process, and
yeah.
not in the script.
Because there was a scene where the safe literally falls on the dog,
mm-hmm.
and you see it, and the woman walks away a little bit, and mm-hmm. the leash trails out.
Yeah.
So there was that. But there was
so you knew that the dog was not okay, but you knew that a real dog didn't die or wasn't hurt. You know, I mean, and that's the thing. It's like the little movie tricks. And, you know, and it does sometimes come down to, like, directors are going to make decisions for you if you're not directing your own script. Directors are going to make decisions for you. Editors are going to make decisions for you. Like, a lot of storytelling happens in editing. A lot.
So would you say that this is a good and valuable lesson for keeping children out of peril or showing...
I would say it's about tone. And that was the point of my story.
I mean, because if you're making a thriller and something is about a kid being kidnapped, you have to feel the kid's
yeah.
in peril. I mean, if you're making a family film, the level of peril depends on what you're going in, what world you're dealing with, you know, what the actual story is. So it's allowed. It just depends on the genre and tone you're writing in.
Yeah. We were talking about a movie called Compliance the other night at dinner, and I don't know if any of you have seen it or know the conceit, but it's basically about, very short description, it's basically about a guy, and this was based on a true story, who called into like a McDonald's and talked to the manager and pretended to be the police and said, we caught one of your employees stealing from one of your customers, and you do to basically sequester her in your office until we can get there. And then it's a thriller, and it keeps going on. And what the manager ends up doing to this poor girl who was accused of this is horrible, and it gets worse and worse and worse and worse. And I bring this up because that's the situation where you have like an 18-year-old employee. So I mean, they're not a child, but they're still a young person who is very much at the mercy of the people who are there. But this is an R-rated movie with adults in it that is meant for an adult audience and definitely not for kids. And so you can get away with the kinds of horrible stuff that happens to this person that you would never do in a movie if you had that exact same premise, although you would never have that premise for a kid's movie. But I mean, you'd have like that where there was some possible way to spin this in a comedic world, you know, that you wouldn't do to this person. So it's about targeting your audience. Again, it's knowing the tone of your movie and who your audience is so that you can pitch your characters and their situations accordingly. And I think anything, I mean, the exact same situation in a horror movie, if you take that same thing and put it in a comedy, the situation can be totally the same, but you're changing, like, the tone, you're changing the musical cues, you're changing the environment around them so it's brighter colors and less dark and threatening. You know, like, those types of things, which aren't necessarily always in the screenwriter's control, but are based on what is usually in the script, can change how people react to your characters and what you can get away with or can't.
Does that answer your question? Yeah.
Is there actually like a literal quota for F-bombs before you get bumped into R?
Yes. There's so many. I don't know the number, but there's so many.
I'm sure there is.
There is actually, I don't know.
I think
might
about
be one.
One non-sexual F-word.
You get so many and then you're bumped.
Yeah. And it is context.
Context,
it's
yeah.
about what you're describing and why.
You can have something that you think is very violent, but the blood isn't, like, if you made
yeah.
a choice and it's not red blood, it's orange blood.
Right.
Like, they violently kill this alien, but the blood that comes out is spewing green. And you're like, man, how is this not R-rated? Because it's not realistic.
Mm-hmm.
But you're thinking to yourself how violent this is. And that it's that element of, well, can't be based in reality. It doesn't look like a real person, you know. So that all factors into it in an interesting way.
It's probably not something that we should really worry about too much in writing the original thing. Would you say, like, for example, if an executive is reading something and they're telling themselves, well, this is going to be R, but will they also in the back of their mind say, now we can fix this and make it PG, you know?
I don't think you should be thinking that at all. I also think that's another one where thriller, genre comes in, like, and knowing who your market is, you know. I think when you have an R-rated comedy, you worry more, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, an R-rated comedy, you're automatically, there are companies that specialize in those types of movies because that's what they are good at doing and that's the budgets that they're looking for and those are the types of movies that they want to make. And so that they're willing to put out a $25 million movie or whatever because they know that they'll get a good return on their investment for it. You know, the original Hangover was made for not very much
money. It was made
money,
for nothing.
But it was a huge success.
It was a huge success. And so the next one had to be made for a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
But then they made their money back. And then the theory is why they're doing a third is the same thing. It's got, like, a cult following now.
I think as writers, all you should be worried about, I mean, let the executives figure that stuff out. Like, they can figure out how they need to change things in order to get certain ratings. You're always going to get notes no matter what. You're never going to turn in a script and the executive on the end of it says, perfect, we're not changing anything, because that's just not how it works. Hollywood is a collaborative environment, you know? And so, unless you're writing and directing and producing and doing all of it yourself, where you have complete creative control, you know, you're not going to ever run into that situation. So don't worry about that. Just know the tone and know the genre and write great characters and write what you want to write and don't worry about it. I mean, the thing about, like, language, for example, just because that's specifically what you're asking about, is, like, don't be gratuitous with it unless you are actively seeking to have, unless there's a conscious creative choice for why you're
there's
doing
a reason
that.
Why your character speaks that way.
Yeah.
Then do it. But if not, you can, when you're reading a script, and I probably read more scripts like this than you do, but, like, when you're like, they're just gratuitously, like, saying cuss words, there's no reason behind it. Like, there's no real emotion, like, they're really, really angry, or, you know, it's a comic beat where they've just, you know, done something to themselves, you know, they've just stubbed this, their foot, and you know there's going to be, like, the natural reaction of somebody is to cuss when they injure themselves accidentally, or when it's just gratuitously there, and you're like, really?
Yeah.
I mean, I, as an assistant once, I did have to go through, and this was something we bought, it's in development, and they said, God, it feels like there's a lot more cussing for some reason on this pass. And they hadn't decided if it was going to be something that was eventually going to be an R or a PG-13. We hadn't even gotten that process, you know. We didn't have a cast yet or anything. And they went, yeah, you need to go through and write down how many. Because they wanted to show to the director who's now rewriting it himself, you might have just gone over the top on this. Like, look at how much these characters cuss and what's the reasoning for it.
Yeah.
It worked before without it. You need motivation. Like, and he was like, oh, I guess you're right. I kind of got into it. And he toned it down. It wasn't about the rating. It was like, why all of a sudden are you cussing so much, you know?
So I see a lot of family films that are just the adult storyline is really watered down, and I'm wondering, like, what do you see in the process that causes that, or how do you really make great family entertainment that truly appeals to people at all levels instead of just a bunch of silly gags for the kids and the adults are bored?
In my opinion, it's all about character. It's character and emotion. And that's why Disney and Pixar, for example, are masters at this. We spend a ton of time. We spend months, solid months, on figuring out our characters and making sure that every single scene in the movie, everything is about our characters and it's driven by them and that there is a strong emotional through line. You go through and you look at our movies and it's like there's a reason for every scene. There's an emotion behind everything that happens. And so it works on many different levels. Kids are entertained just by, like, Finding Nemo, for example, probably a movie everybody in here has seen, right? Like, and you love that as an adult, too. It's a fantastic movie, you know? But if you have kids, you love it in a whole different way. You're entertained because this is a cool world, and this is these characters are so fun. You love Nemo, and you love Marlin, and you love Dory. I mean,
you love that Dory doesn't remember things.
Dory's hilarious. You love, as a kid, you love the sharks because they're kind of scary and they're big and they're weird and they're funny. And then adults love it because they're freaking vegetarian sharks. You know what I mean? And kids don't really necessarily know what that means yet, but we get it and we understand. And then we also, as adults, relate to the fact that, like, this is basically a story about a father having to learn how to let his son grow up and go. You know, and we as adults understand that and relate to that. That's not what kids are seeing. They're seeing this fun story about fishes out in the ocean, you know? And so it's finding those resonant themes and emotional meaning behind things and letting that drive your characters. And that's when you get the good quality stuff. You know, it's when you have movies like that, and I can't think of a good one off the top of my head, but when you have movies where your characters are making choices that are obviously made because they need to further the plot, you know, then you lose interest because you know as an adult, like, that's not something that this character would actually do. I just don't believe it. You lose believability. And you disengage because you go, they're just trying to make this plot happen, you know, and so the character isn't believable anymore. And kids might let that go. They're not maybe as totally savvy in that. They're still being entertained by the fact that it's a talking dog or whatever.
Yeah.
But you're losing your adult audience in the process, and it's going to be a movie that adults aren't going to want to watch over and over and over again. Yeah.
That makes sense. So, and those movies, people haven't put as much time into the character.
Yeah. All of our movies, and I really believe this is partly why they're so successful, start from a very personal place. A very personal story, which is partly why they feel so real. It's going back to Finding Nemo, and I told one of you guys the story, I forget who, but you know, that movie grew out of Andrew Stanton, who directed it. When his son was like 3 years old, they were out somewhere together and his son got lost in a big box store. I think it was like a Home Depot. And Andrew was like freaking out. He's like, oh my god, I've lost my 3-year-old in this huge enormous store. I can't find him. He's this tiny child in this huge place. And you know, they finally found each other and everything was fine. But out of that came that realization, like that emotion, that reaction was so universal. I mean, every parent has had that feeling at some point because every kid gets lost somehow in some way, you know, like I remember getting lost in a department store when I was a kid, you know, like you just, it's a parent's worst nightmare, right? It's to lose your child. And as a child, every kid remembers that feeling of being like separated from your parents and lost and how scary that feeling is, but also exhilarating. And so he realized that there was a movie there, and then he thought, okay, well, now I have my sort of theme that I'm working with and this emotional core of my movie. What is the best possible world to set this story in? And he realized, well, what's the worst possible place on Earth to get lost would be the ocean, the biggest thing on the planet that you could possibly get lost in, you know? And so that's how that came to be. So it's thinking about those types of things. And I think that part of the reason our movies are so successful is we start from that emotional, thematic place. And we then figure out from there. And then you build your characters, your world to support that.
And I think it's very needed for a family film. I mean, it's needed for most films in general. You have to have that emotional, but like that very simple, relatable, emotional feeling that both adults and children can tap into is what creates a very successful family film. Mm-hmm. So, like, and we keep bringing up Pixar examples because they're great, but, like...
There's the most recent current kind of example.
But also, I mean, like, there's not a lot of other places... I mean, like, okay, Kung Fu Panda, I think kids and adults tap into. Mm-hmm. The Jack Black character, I'm blanking on the panda's name, but his desire... Thank you. To want to be
more.
Yeah. To be... He wants to be a hero. And that's similar with The Incredibles. It's like, Dad wants to be what he used to be again. Mm-hmm. He wants to have that feeling again. He wants to be, you know, the hero mm-hmm. again. And so we all understand that.
And by the way, these are movies... The movies that we're talking about are, like... One of the things that we always think about is like a sense of timelessness. You want your films to be timely, but also timeless. That's our driving principle in the sense that you could watch The Incredibles now, even though that movie was made 10 years ago, I think it was at this point. Like, and it's still relevant because the themes are relevant and you can understand it. Whereas, for example, a movie like, and I'm saying this because I don't think that's the only way you have to make movies. A movie like Shrek, for example, was extremely successful, hugely successful. And it was a great movie, but there is a built-in time code on that one. You know, that was like, you can't, because all of the references, all the,
yeah.
It was such a pop culture, like, fun, which made it fun to see at the time, and that's why it was such a huge success.
That was a choice, because they could have done a movie like that, spoofing mm-hmm. fantasy land, like, fantasy characters, fairy tales, and not have it feel so pop culture.
That's exactly my point. Yeah. Is like, it doesn't. But they were still hugely successful with it. You know, so it doesn't. It's not like you have to do it. There's not only one way to do it. I mean, my personal preference and taste might be this one, but so what? Like, if I have a 5-year-old and then I take him to Shrek, I'm not going to care. I just want them to be entertained. You know, so it's about making just fun movies too. At the end of the day, it's, you know, it's entertainment. You don't want it to be some.
Yeah.
Just,
I mean, I would say for people who do family films, like, if the parent walks out going, I kind of enjoyed that, mm-hmm. you've got to win.
Yeah.
Now, is that something that Pixar and other companies might be more comfortable doing, is taking something that kind of fits the four quadrants at a certain level, but tonally they take it into a darker direction?
We don't think about the marketing when uh-huh. we start with our movies. We're a director-driven studio, and what that means is that our directors who are they're employees of Pixar and of Disney. They grew up, they started as animators or storyboarders or whatever, and they grew up in the ranks and worked their way up to director. They pitch 3 ideas to John Lasseter, and it's 3 on purpose, because you want to have 3 different ideas, 3 different worlds, not put all your eggs in one basket and just see what kind of hits, but all of them come from a place of personal interest or belief or emotion, whatever it may
like
be.
Like the story she was talking about, Andrew.
Yeah.
Like that was one of...
Yeah. That was one of the 3 that he pitched, yeah. was this idea for the Finding Nemo thing. And so they start from a place of what the director is interested in. And then those ideas are pitched, and John basically chooses, greenlights one of them to keep going forward. But that process... is kept as pure as it possibly can.
Right. I just thought it was interesting that that Pixar seems a little bit more willing to go into that darker area.
I remember what I was going to say. You know, one thing that to quote Andrew Stanton again, we don't make movies for kids. Uh-huh. We make movies that we like, that we want to see. It just so happens that kids like them too. And that's the sensibility of our studio. The people who are, the directors who are in our studio, the people who find their way. There are certain directors who would never work in our world because they don't have the same type of sensibility or desire to make the kinds of movies that are able to be made and released through Pixar and Disney. The reason I say that is, like, it comes from the sensibility of the directors.
Right.
We don't come up with, we are not sitting in a room saying, what is the next movie that's going to be on the zeitgeist? We need to figure out a movie about... you know, what are kids going to be into next? That's not what we do. We say, what is the world that I am interested in exploring? What is the emotion that I know is, that I am interested in right now, that I know will be appealing to a universal audience? you know.
Well, I would just say it was interesting that process, and it leads to a little bit more exploration of.
We're not afraid of darkness. I mean, I think honestly, like, kids are freaking smart.
Well, I think that follows the Disney tradition. I mean, Pinocchio is
extremely dark,
and
Dumbo is terrible. Has a
Rocky.
It's terrible. They're a mother and child are torn apart from each other in a really horrible way. Bambi, the mom is shot in the first few minutes. You know, there's we deal with a lot of dark stuff in our movies.
Yeah.
But that goes back to fairy tales. I mean. Way before Disney even existed, fairy tales were, I mean, originally they weren't actually stories for children, they were stories for adults that adults then started crafting to tell their children as moral lessons, you know? And it's like, they're dark. Like, you go back and read the Brothers Grimm, like some of the early stuff before it was copied, like, in Cinderella, the oldest stepsister, when they come out and try on the glass shoe, cuts off her big toe, and, like, the younger one is, like, shaving her heel to try and, I mean, it's horribly gruesome, you know? But kids can handle that.
And the cat dies, too. People always forget the cat dies.
In the movie, or
in the Cinderella, in the movie.
Oh, really?
I thought the movie had some of the darker elements. That's a pretty light older Disney.
It is. If you give them something to anchor onto, then kids will be okay with it. You know, I mean, like in Toy Story 3, for example, like, they love those characters, and you want to feel scared when they're about to die. Like, that's, I mean, that's part of it, is you want to feel that gut-wrenching feeling, like, oh my God, I don't want these people who I love to be incinerated, you know? And then you find the way out of it. You find that was an incredibly emotional moment, because the characters bonded together and basically said, we're a family, no matter what happens to us. I will always love you, and I will always be there for you. And it, like, brings tears to your eyes, because you realize that there's an emotional reason for it to be there. It wasn't gratuitous.
Right. No. Yeah. I was very interested, because I've seen the difference between it. Definitely have very different tones, and I haven't seen some of the other animation branches go.
And I feel like we keep talking about animation, but I'm having a really hard time thinking about live action family movies that have been successful.
Well, I mean,
recently.
It's also, I mean, well, that's the whole thing. The divide of what's successful and what's not in the family film is a little different.
Yeah.
You know, like, do you look at quality over box office? Like, I'd say The Odd Life of Timothy Green is a family film. And to me, it was successful. It was very emotional. Kids that I know, like, enjoyed it. It helped them learn about... It was a tool also about exploring the idea of adoption and things like that. But it's not like a box office gangbuster. And sometimes...
Pirates of the Caribbean. Would be a good example.
Yeah.
But that's not necessarily just a family film.
No, that's an action film.
It's an action film.
And each one has definitely got more about action and less about the comedy, I think, than the first one.
Yeah.
So it is that weird, you know, and they are measured on different levels of success. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, The Diary of the Wimpy Kids, they made three of them, you know. The last one, I think, they were a little disappointed with the box office, but they went for it in releasing it in summer because it was called The Dog Days of Summer, and they were really pushing for that. The rest of them had always been released earlier, and so they did better. Mm-hmm. You know, Percy Jackson, who thought they were going to make another one? It did well enough. They're shooting a second one right now.
Wow,
they're doing
really?
Another one from the series, you know. So it is, because they make them for a, it's made for a price.
Mm-hmm.
You know what, you know, you're going to get. Like, this is... And if you want to keep the same lead, you have to make some of those decisions quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Not everything's going to be like Harry Potter, where it just blows up and, you know you have a time period.
Mm-hmm.
And so, those choices. I will say a lot of family films that are made are based on books or some kind of existing property, because they feel a little bit more comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And especially then they really pay attention to that price.
Now, I'm interested in the appeal of existing intellectual property for four-quadrant movies, especially when they choose very, I mean, not necessarily obscure, but at least obscure for children, like the Tintin movie,
mm-hmm.
which is not widely read in the U.S.
But that was made for that
overseas.
That was a choice of, we know this will be huge overseas.
Mm.
That this is a comic that everyone in the United States is where its smallest market is. And kids did. I mean, some kids. Yeah, I think more young boys liked it with it, because he's, you know, he's an adventurer and the dog and like. But they knew. I mean, it even released over in Europe before it released here. Also, now there's a trend of picture books being developed in the movies.
Harold and the Purple Crayon.
But as a writer, you can't pay attention to that, I feel like.
Yeah, you just gotta write.
You just gotta write what's whatever. And especially
and
with family
so cheesy,
films.
But it's true. Like, you have to write what feels right to you, what stories and themes that work for you, and find the right characters to tell that story and the right world to put that in.
May I ask a question about adaptations?
Yeah.
Along these lines? I've actually been hired to write adaptations, and sometimes the structure of the book is not good filmmatic structure. It just doesn't
mm-hmm.
match.
Correct.
And I've been in a lot of discussions, both with you know, authors as well as other people, about films have a certain structure, books have a certain structure, book structure doesn't really match the film structure. Can we meet at some middle ground to maybe fit one into the other or something like that? And I guess what I'm rounding around to is how, what is a good way to, or how is it possible to negotiate, or what is a good strategy to negotiate the adaptation of something? How would a person doing an adaptation bring that up without offending
the author or the producer?
I couldn't say.
Well, no, I mean, here's the thing, is if you're a producer or a studio and you've optioned this material, you know you're not as you love the material, but you're not as attached to it.
Mm-hmm.
You realize you're going to have to drop characters, blend characters, maybe flip things around. I feel like part of your goal as an adaptation, as when you're an executive on something that's an adaptation, is to try and stay as true to the themes, the emotions, and the characters in the book,
mm-hmm.
that what it makes you feel and create. Versus, and the plot has to line up exactly, because sometimes it doesn't. Like, and there's some stuff that you just have to drop because there could be too many characters, you know, and you have 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't have...
If you filmed the book would, the movie would be 5 hours long.
I mean,
you
like,
can't do that.
The great example is Pride and Prejudice. There's the miniseries, right? And there's the movie.
Mm-hmm.
I appreciate both for different things. Now, the miniseries is like 8 hours.
Mm-hmm.
You get to go into everything about every character's story. The movie's a little over 2, and you really are picking up the essence, like, you're really focusing on, like, those 2 main stories, you know, like... Or the 3 that you need to move the plot along, you can't get into all the quirky little side stories. It's just got to be the main thing moving
mm-hmm.
it. So, I think that's it. What you know now, an author has a hard time understanding that sometimes.
Sometimes, yeah.
Especially
they
if they've never
worked. They have ownership over it for
and
justifiable
if
reasons.
If they've never worked in
mm-hmm.
this industry, they don't. You have to hope to try and bring them around to be like, I'm going to keep the essence and the core and the themes that you want, but I need to change this because it just doesn't... It won't flow. It won't work for
mm-hmm.
a movie. And I think you try and sell it that way. Like, I'm not going to damage the integrity of the character you've created and make sure every choice you make is staying true to that statement.
Mm-hmm.
Is, I don't know if you feel
no,
that
I
way,
think,
but
I
that's the way you go about it, you know? And some people, like, just, I mean, I know there are people who adapt books who just take, like, 3 things and throw the rest away.
Mm-hmm.
And I do have questions with that sometimes. Like, they even change characters so majorly where you're like,
this has nothing to do with
the book. This has nothing to do with the book. Why bother?
Yeah.
You know?
It's an individual case, but, you know, Leah's right. I have nothing more to add except that it's an individual author's situation. Like, each author's going to be different. And the hope would be that the author would know. I mean, presumably there's some sort of agent involved somewhere, because if the book is published, I mean, unless you're dealing with unpublished material, which is a whole other thing, but if the book is published and the person probably has an agent somewhere along there, even if it's only a literary agent, but somewhere they sold the rights to you or to the producer who's having you adapt it. So hopefully they've been set up for some sort of realization that you can't film a book.
The other reality is, if it's something where the book's been optioned or purchased by a studio, unless the author was very powerful or had some... Like, Stephen King has a lot of say.
Right.
He's over his material. But if it's a newcomer,
mm-hmm.
they don't have any of that say,
mm-hmm.
really. I mean, the studio will want to make them happy because they won't want them griping, but your job is to make the studio happy,
yeah.
not
the author.
You know, sometimes they get like an executive producer credit, but they don't have any say over who the writer is or who directs it or any casting choices, you know.
And that is something that they have given up by
choice,
selling the rights to the book.
But
you know,
it is a yin and a yang, because
yeah,
like for every situation,
it's,
I'd say there's
different.
More situations where the writer has no say,
yeah,
has no involvement, shows up at the premiere.
Yeah, no,
they're given two tickets and they get to see it early, maybe, and they want to. They'll bring them to set one day because they want EPK video of them on set, and you know,
yeah,
talking about it. And of course, those interviews are usually really good because it's before they've seen the movie and you know they're happy still. But you know, then you have like J.K. Rowling or Stephanie Meyer or E.L. James, who's got like incredibly stupid amount of control, like in a way, you know, like she gets. She got to have a say in which producer got it on that lot. And she's going to have a say in casting, and she's going to have a say in the writer, you know, like. But, you know, if I wrote a book, I'd get none of that right now. Unless
yeah,
it took off in some way. So I think that's the number one priority, is always to the person who hired you to write the screenplay.
Mm-hmm.
So when you guys were in development, how did you scout for new writers? And, like, I know
yeah,
a lot of the Pixar development people, they don't necessarily read family specs. They read, like, indie dramas or whatever.
They don't read.
So what kind of, like, specs do you guys personally like to read? And just in general, how do you go about scouting?
I think we're going to have very different answers to this question.
Yes, because we do different types of
different
things.
Yeah.
Sure.
Depending on the company I'm working at,
yes,
but I'm always, like, original voices. It's a big thing for me. It's original voice. If, you know, when I'm looking for family stuff, I always want to make sure there's someone who's... Because I think most family films have some comedy element in it, but emotion at the same time. So if I read a script that it's supposed to be a family film and I don't laugh or have some lightness at certain moments, it's like, okay, maybe not, you know. So I actually read a lot of comedy samples to see about writers. When I was at Disney Channel, I would read tons of comedy samples. And then I'd say, I love this sample, I love this writer. Do they have any interest in writing the Disney Channel? And they'd go, for, you know, have coming up, do they have any ideas that might work or want to? And their agent would be like, well, I don't know. And I'd be like, well, find out if they have kids and they want to do something that their kids can see. You know?
Yeah.
And kind of go about it that way, because really, like, some of these are, like, and it could be really raunchy, but still have heart.
Mm-hmm.
And that's in the part, I'm looking for that, like, having heart, the having that emotion.
And that's because Leah worked for Disney, and that's a studio that's very important. If she had worked for, say, Fox, that might be less important, and she would just be looking for the pure raunch and just let's make, you know,
yeah,
the funniest movie possible, and if that includes...
When I was at Imagine, we would never make a comedy just to be raunchy.
Yeah.
And we're never, like, there's always got to be a core... The character always has to have some kind of change and go on some kind of journey.
Yeah.
It was a
that's
given
true,
in every... But, like, I feel some places, like in a comedy...
I mean, it's
know,
less important some places, but
yeah,
I think that, you know...
You know, I've always worked for companies where that is very
yeah,
important.
So
just,
you're how you...
Oh.
Because she does find material different than me.
I do. Well, I also don't find material. I find writers,
yes,
which is different because I'm not looking... So in my particular role, and this is true of Disney feature animation only, and Pixar only, so this is, that's why it's like, it's kind of, it's not necessarily the best,
that's great work,
most applicable for the world at large, but,
your name?
So what I'm looking for is,
oh,
is a writer who has an interesting voice, who does character really well, that's always the first thing that we look for, character and emotion, and so as a result, we do end up reading a lot of indie movies. You know, I read a lot of, like, coming-of-age type stories, and I read a lot of just more, less mainstream type stuff. Like, I read Forgetting Sarah Marshall, okay? And that would have been normally, like, that would have been probably great for your world, because the characters are good, the emotion is there, and it's a funny thing, but for me... The focus is more on just the silly comedy of it, and the script that I read, which was different from the movie, but,
yeah,
and so I ended up, like, I didn't bring that writer in, because it just wasn't the right fit for our types of movies. So it just, you know, and then it also depends if I'm reading just to read and try and find new writers, like, we're constantly kind of looking
yeah,
to bring people in and talk with, or if I'm trying to actually actively pair one of my directors with something that they're
yeah,
actively working on and would want to, you know, find a writer for that. So it depends a little bit. her, Leah's answer is probably much more applicable to what you guys are doing.
And is it normally comedies, though, you're reading?
Oh, no, both.
Oh,
one of the best scripts that I read a long time ago was this horribly dark comedy about an orphaned girl who had horrible... was living on the street. But I mean, but the character was phenomenal.
Oh,
and, you know, but usually comedy, I mean, that wouldn't, that sample alone wouldn't have been enough to get that writer a job in my world. They would have had to have shown some affinity for comedy and lightness and family type of world and emotion. But that's what got me intrigued by it. And asked me, you know, forced me to call up the agent and say, hey, do you have any other samples for this guy? Or, like Leah said, does this person have kids? Because a lot of times, a lot of these people will have samples that wouldn't be applicable at all. But you find out, yeah, I want to actually do a movie that my kid can see. So, you know,
and they have the writing skill that they know how to do that.
Yeah.
But, you know, that has to be taken down just a little bit, not as dark.
Yeah.
You know, tone it down a little.
Yeah.
What was your question?
Do either of you have an opinion or an angle on the future of media, especially with the internet and things related, and how that might impact or provide greater opportunities for writers, for instance?
I think it's really going to change kids' programming, because I think it's a generation that's going to grow up using iPads or Nooks or things like that to read and watch material much more than any of us in this room did. So for them, it will be normal to, I'm just going to watch this show that's on YouTube has on that comes every Thursday that's a 5-minute animated thing. I think that it's going to open that up a lot for that kind of programming, I think, in the family space, and I think in the comedy space. I think some areas, and this is my personal opinion, aren't going to do as well because the experience of seeing it on the big screen or with a group of people, or, you know, you could make it look good for the effects for that small screen, but if you go and plug it into your TV and then watch it, you're like, wow, that looks crappy, kind of thing. So I think it's going to be that. And I think, and then that could shift, though, for the next, you know, 50 years from now, because people are so used to doing things that that's how they do everything. But I do think in the family space, it will change things a lot. I think it will open things up a lot. I think you'll see people creating their own content and putting it up there, and if it's kid-friendly, parents will be like, well, of course you should watch it, and kids are going to want to. And, you know, you have things like YouTube creating, like, a channel. Like, Awesomeness is a YouTube channel, and it's meant for kids. And, like, the new things premiere at, like, 3:30, because that's, like, when they get home, you know? And it's, like, kind of silly, outrageous comedy. It's, like, a kid's comedy channel. But, like, they're specifically just for them, and when kids find out about it, they're going to go to it. And then, how do you monetize that? You have an ad before or after that some toy companies put there.
Mm-hmm.
And you're directly, specifically hitting your market. I think it's hard. That's why I think it's harder with adults. It's like, well, how do I know who really, like, when you get to kids, you know, if you've got toys or games or this, they're you want, you know exactly where you want to go.
Mm-hmm.
So I do think it's going to broaden it for writers and that thing to be able to create stuff. And then you might have...
Yeah.
You know, actually, you bring up a really interesting point. I work in internet technology for the most part, and depending on the size of your screen, you will have different things available to you. We all know that from iPads and iPhones and things like that. We get different content. But if you do the same thing in the future with the special effects, for instance, or the way things are shot, depending on the size of the screen, the shooting might be different or the effect might be different. Interesting.
Well, no, because that's why I think, like, comedy videos, like, Funny or Die comedy videos are great. Like, they work on your computer, because, like, it's a different feel. Like, you don't need it to look as glossy always with comedy or this or that. You're going to do an action piece and put it online. You got to be really specific and careful, or a sci-fi, because it's just... You know, what quality, like, if you're going to shoot it on film to make it look that good, then why are you going to put it online? You're spending all that money, it should be on the screen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, so you have your levels, and then you have cameras and technology are changing and advancing, but it's just, that's why I think we're seeing video, like, comedy videos thrive online.
Mm-hmm.
And it works for that attention span, like, you know, that short attention span we've been drawn into.
Mm-hmm.
How much do the four quadrants apply to TV?
They don't play the same. I mean, neither of us work in TV, but... I mean, yes, you want, like... The example of a four-quadrant show on TV is, like, American Idol or The X Factor.
Modern Family.
Well, yeah. But, like, they remember in TV they have... You know something that's at 10 o'clock at night is not supposed to be for...
It's targeted.
It's much targeted, and that plays into the marketing effect of it a lot. Like, where you... And what you can show when and all that.
Yeah.
So I guess, yes, there is an equivalent of it. I'd say in the old days it was like variety shows.
Right. Yeah.
And it's a version of variety shows again now, except we call them competition reality shows, you know. But then there's weird things you'd be amazed of. Like, kids really like cooking shows.
I didn't know that.
Kids like watching the Food Network. There's a section of kids that like watching the Food Network. Duff Goldman, they loved him, you know. Ace of Cakes and all that. Because think about it, he's kind of like a child like himself. He's a big kid. He's making these cool cakes and doing these fun things, and kids like enjoyed that. But parents had no problem watching it either.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that's an interesting way to look at it. I think what you hope for is, if you're doing children's programming, is it's something that parents will be willing to watch too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I had nothing to do with the development of it, but it came out when I was at Disney Channel's Gravity Falls.
Mm.
Have you seen it?
I love it.
It's a great animated show.
It is.
That adults and kids like.
It's very smart.
It's very smart. It's got multiple levels going on. It's so bright and colorful, or like got such a distinct palette and visual style. Mm. Kids like it. But the young girl character is hilarious. I mean, like...
Yeah.
The kids are hilarious. And so I would call that four quadrant. They were aiming to make sure parents enjoyed it, I feel like. And they're probably, you know, I don't know if I'm watching it at the same time all the kids I know watch it. I'm probably watching it later when it's in rerunning and like later at night because they're on 24 hours a day, you know. But yeah, so there is that version of that.
In the case of the pitch, would it sort of be... Would it really be the writer's job to say, you know, open a pitch, okay, this is a four-quadrant movie? That's
no, maybe some executives like that. I find that so off-putting.
It's a little annoying.
You don't know the business, you don't need to worry about it. Like, I want to hear what your creative ideas are.
But if you want to start off saying this is a family film, that doesn't bother me.
That's genre.
That's not... You know, or, you know, yeah, but to be like... If you, in your mind, you're like, I'm writing this action film that's this huge four-quadrant, you just say... It's a big action film.
Mm-hmm.
Don't throw in the four
quadrants. Yeah. You get the four quadrants through your pitch of telling who your characters are and what kind of themes you're dealing with.
They're the ones who are deciding it. They're the ones who are watching.
Exactly.
Yeah. One of those things that drives me nuts, and now I've done it more than I like to do, but saying, it's this meets this. I'm like, really?
That's amazing. Short.
Can you not, like... But sometimes what I prefer is tonally it will remind you of. Like,
yeah.
Tonally it's like this.
One of the biggest pieces of advice, I think, to summarize kind of what Leah and I both were just responding to your question, is like, don't try and speak the jargon and the language and like... sell us in that sense on the business side of it. Like, that's our
job. Let your agent do that.
Let your agent figure that out. Like, just sell us on how great your characters are and your world is. Because we're not buying your business. We're buying your creative ideas. We're buying the fact that you have an interesting voice and an interesting story to tell. Don't worry about the other stuff. I mean, even if you are, I mean, you should be thinking about it in your own life, in your own world, and when you're crafting these things. But, like, when someone pitches that to me, it just makes me, it's off-putting. It just makes you feel like, I don't know. It feels smarmy. And that's not what you're trying to do, you know? And that's not who you people are. Like, that's not what you know? That's not what you want to sell. You want to sell your ideas. You know?
I mean, I can say most of the time, if I'm like you, I don't like it. But I've had some writers put it in a great way where they say, like, my hope is to make something that tonally reminds you of. And the way it's delivered, that line, my hope is, da-da-da-da-da, not like, this is.
Yeah.
It's how you couch the words.
It is.
But I would say avoid anything that, let your, whoever represents you do that.
Yeah.
Because let us be annoyed by them doing it, than you.
Yeah.
Like, I've actually said to agents, really? You're telling me it's this meets this? Seriously?
Mm. Okay. You can have that argument with that. You know, it's like, you're the creative end.
Yeah.
Allow yourself to be the creative end and revel in it. You know? There's not many opportunities to do that in this business, so.
Yeah, I'm going to agree with that.
No. Thank you, you guys. That's great. Good luck, all of you. I really wish you the best.
If you missed out on your chance to apply for the 2013 retreat, never fear. Entries for the 2014 CineStory Screenwriting Awards and Fellowship open on October 1st. More details at cinestory.org/contest. CineStory would like to thank Don Bowden for use of the track Home from his album This One's Gonna Leave a Mark. Don is a composer for film, TV and other media. To find out more about Don's work, visit donbowden.com. And finally, CineStory is a non-profit organization. So if you like what you hear, consider supporting CineStory in these podcasts by making a donation at cinestory.org/support us. Until next time, happy writing.